Conservative? You bet. Controversial? Right again. It's time to squabble on the Jim Benson Show.
Are you going to get coronavirus? And if so, how sick will you get? Will you die? These are questions on everyone's mind these days as our nation and the world shifts into high gear with efforts to deal with this now worldwide pandemic. We'll be giving you answers on today's show. So, hello and welcome to another edition of the Jim Benson Show, conservative talk radio covering the issues that concern you here on the BBS Radio Network. If you'd like to call into the show, the phone number is 888-627-6008. That's 888-627-6008. First, let's review the coronavirus pandemic situation currently with some of the latest statistics and events. Just what is the coronavirus, also known as COVID-19, an acronym for Coronavirus Disease 2019? According to the World Health Organization, coronaviruses are a large family of viruses that cause illnesses ranging from the common cold to more severe diseases such as the Middle East Respiratory Syndrome, MERS, and Severe Acute Respiratory Syndrome, SARS. Coronavirus disease, or COVID-19, is a new strain that was discovered in 2019 and has not been previously identified in humans. Believed to have originated, or at least been discovered, in Wuhan, China late last year, this highly infectious disease has rapidly spread worldwide. As of today, the World Health Organization reports on its website that there were 294,110 confirmed cases of coronavirus across the globe, with 12,944 deaths. Now, that's including some 187 countries, areas, or territories with cases. These things are changing by the minute, of course, but based on a WHO study of more than 55,000 cases, here are the top five most common symptoms of COVID-19 and the percentage of people who had them. Number one is fever, 88%. Number two is dry cough, 68%. Number three is fatigue, 38%. Number four, coughing up sputum or thick phlegm from the lungs, 33%. And number five is shortness of breath, 19%. The good news, according to one state health summary I read, is that most people who have gotten sick, about 80%, have had mild or moderate symptoms and can manage their symptoms at home. Those who appear to be most at risk are elderly people and those with compromised immune systems due to existing medical conditions. Despite all the hysteria and hype about COVID-19 in the left-wing dominated mainstream media, along with some of the alternative right-wing media, it's important to keep in mind that here in America, we are not nearly as bad off as some other nations, at least at present, and unprecedented steps are being taken to help protect us. For one thing, health authorities have learned much more since previous pandemics, including the 1918 flu pandemic that killed an estimated 50 to 100 million people worldwide, and the need to isolate patients is well understood. Also, there are many new antiviral and other drugs now available, including antibiotics, that help combat this disease, and promising new substances are being looked at. Also, President Trump banned flights carrying some 10,000 Chinese nationals a day into the U.S. on February 3rd and was promptly denounced as racist, along with other non-citizens. The flights carrying 10,000 Chinese nationals along with other non-citizens were banned on February 3rd in response to the COVID-19 epidemic. And, of course, Trump was roundly criticized for that and denounced as racist, of course. Now, the U.S. borders with Canada and Mexico are being closed to non-essential travel to further help stem the rate of infection. And I don't think we want to forget that this whole madness of open borders brought to you by the Democrat, communist, globalist conspirers, I would call them, should be considered by people. What would happen if we left our borders open? This is a problem with the European Union, and that is also why Trump has banned flights from there and why those countries, among them particularly Italy and Greece, are having such a problem with it now. Here's a look at the U.S. statistics on COVID-19 infection. Those figures continue to rise, of course, but as of yesterday, actually as of today, and it has been updated slightly, but a situation report by the U.S. Federal Centers for Disease Control showed a total of 15,219 confirmed and presumptive coronavirus cases. Yesterday it said with 221 deaths. Today it's been downgraded to 201 deaths, I believe. And of course, those figures are being updated. But when you consider that a country of about, what, somewhere between 350, 400 million, if you include illegal aliens and visitors, we have 15,219 cases, confirmed and presumptive cases, and 200 deaths. Keep in mind that these figures are for the entire country. So as you can see, the vast majority of us are not, at least not yet, sick. And probably most of us are not infected either. Of course, we'll expect these figures to rise as testing becomes more extensive. And that's also coming about rapidly. In California, one of the hardest hit states for COVID-19, the California Department of Public Health website, the state's official website on the disease, reported as of yesterday that there were 1,468 positive cases and 27 deaths in California. That's an entire state with the largest, most populous state in the country, with somewhere around 30, 40 million, depending on who you include. And we have officially 1,468 positive cases, people testing positive for coronavirus, and 27 deaths. And of course, that's changing, and we're getting more, as we get more testing going, then you're going to see it rise. But consider that in relation to what's been going on in some other countries and across the world. This included, these figures in California, approximately 25,000 tests that have been conducted between California and private labs. At least 12,528 results have been received, and another 12,700 plus were pending. So, as I said, we will see more of this as these tests come in. With all the testing now and in the coming weeks, we can expect these numbers to increase, of course. California, along with New York and New Jersey, have issued orders for the bulk of their population to stay home except for exercise and essential travel and tasks. I believe that may also include Washington State now. While this cannot go on indefinitely without substantial economic damage, in the short term, this could have a tremendous positive effect on the rate of infection. As our governments and private sector entities swing into action on this matter, you will soon be able to get home test kits for COVID-19 if you are concerned you may have been exposed or infected. Now, the White House has been giving a daily briefing on this situation, and I just recently, an hour or two ago, listened to Trump's introduction to it. These things go on for over an hour. I listened to the one today. Trump spent quite a bit of time detailing the amounts of medical supplies and equipment being sent to the states that are hardest hit. And these include tens of thousands of surgical gowns, surgical masks, protective masks, these M95s that everybody looks for, N95s they call them. he's talked about sending, I believe they call them portable medical units. They used to call them portable hospitals. I think that's what they basically come out to. He mentioned, among others, that they sent some 8 of these field units to California with a total of 2,000 bed capacity. So you can see that the federal government and the state governments are ramping up efforts to fight this thing. And I think it's going to have a very positive effect. Trump did say at the end of his speech in today's briefing that he reiterated that he believes this is going to be over much sooner than many people think. He personally believes that, and that the economy is going to come roaring back. I certainly hope he's right. Let's listen to his comments yesterday at the White House briefing on the coronavirus task force, from the coronavirus task force, the White House coronavirus task force. In that briefing, he does spend more time detailing things that have happened, going overall explaining things that are being done on national level and with the states. Play soundbite one, please.
From the financial, this is a medical situation, not a financial situation. The financial, though, is moving along very nicely. I want to thank you for being here and update you on the progress we've made after a week of extraordinary mobilization in our war against the virus. Governors, mayors, the businesses, charities, and citizens are all working with urgency and speed toward one common goal, which is saving American lives. We're in communication with foreign countries. It's now at 148 foreign countries. Can you believe that? 100, you talk about a spread, you talk about a violent spread. 148 countries. Not even believable. There's been a week of national action and of great national solidarity. People are getting along. We're getting along with Republicans and Democrats and independents and liberals and conservatives. And actually, it's a very nice thing to see. We're all one beautiful, big American family, and that's taking place right now. Last night, I approved a major disaster declaration for the state of New York. I worked very closely with Governor Cuomo. And this is the first time in our nation's history that a president's used the Stafford Act to declare a major disaster in response to a public health crisis. Never happened before. I'm considering other areas where we may or may not be doing that, and working very closely with Gavin Newsom, governor of California, and others. We may be doing the same thing depending on their needs, depending on what they're asking for. It's been unprecedented action in New York, and we've had a tremendous federal response all over the country. And I want to thank all the people in the federal government and obviously in the state governments and local governments. We are working hard. Everybody is working hard. And the people standing alongside of me are working very hard. That I can tell you. We've also reached agreements with Canada and Mexico on new travel rules at our northern and southern borders to halt the entry of the Chinese virus while continuing trade and commerce. And we've had very good talks. With Prime Minister Trudeau, and today, this morning, with President López Obrador. And we talked about joint measures that we're taking to prevent the spread of the virus in our countries and to temporarily suspend non-essential travel. We had a great conversation this morning, President of Mexico, and our close cooperation with Mexico and Canada will keep our people healthy, keep their people healthy, keep everybody safe. Yesterday, I had a call with 12,000 small businesses, representatives of these businesses. That's the engine of our country. People don't realize that. You know, you read all about the big ones, but the small business, when you add them up together, are really the engine, economic engine of our country. And I assured them that my administration is doing everything within its very considerable power, frankly, to support them and their employees. Nobody's ever done what we've done. Likewise, I had calls during the week with all sorts of representatives and systems, like the hospital system. We spoke to many of the hospital systems throughout the country, nurses and doctors, representatives representing hundreds of thousands of nurses and doctors, airlines and cruise ship companies, the business roundtable, which was fully attended, and it's all of the top CEOs of our country and beyond, frankly, the businessmen of really, these are world-styled businessmen. These are businessmen that control the biggest companies in the world. Many of them have taken hits, and many of them are just, you know, going forward. Their businesses have been great. Some have been very badly affected. Some haven't been affected at all. And frankly, some are doing very well. They continue to do very well. It's Walmart, as an example, has been really helpful to us. Doug McMillan, head of Walmart, really helpful to us. And I guess I assume they're doing pretty well because people are certainly buying more than even a clip at Christmas by substantial numbers. Pretty amazing. But they're doing incredibly. They put on tremendous extra staff. You don't have empty shelves. A lot of things have happened that are very good. Restaurants, fast food, executives, grocery stores, all retailers, literally all of them, in groups. And we spoke with the G7 leaders at length, as you know. You probably know about that. Spoke to many of the governors, spoke to almost all of the governors at conference calls and many of the governors individually. And very importantly, the religious leaders. We had a great conversation yesterday, the vice president and myself, with the religious leaders of our country, many of the religious leaders. And we've had a number of them during the course of the last 2 weeks, actually. But yesterday we had a very, very significant call with the religious leaders of our country. I signed legislation providing American workers with paid sick leave and paid family medical leave at no cost to employers, and free testing for those who need it. The testing is going very well, and the admiral will speak to that along with Tony. We're working quickly to pass additional legislation that will provide massive relief to small businesses and affected industries and give direct payments to our great workers and hardworking American families. There's never been anything like we're doing on the Hill right now. They're negotiating. Mitch McConnell, Chuck Schumer, they're all up there. Kevin McCarthy and Nancy Pelosi. They're all negotiating, and everybody's working hard, and they want to get to a solution that's the right solution. I think we're getting very close. We've also announced that we've moved tax day from April 15th to July 15th, which is a big deal, giving businesses and individuals extra time to file and pay without interest or penalty. So we've moved the date way back, and so it'll be July 15th instead of your traditional April 15th. And very importantly, you will have a lot of time, but you're not going to have interest penalties or any kind of penalties by filing at that later date. HUD announced that foreclosures and evictions are suspended for single-family homeowners with FHA-insured mortgages for the next 60 days. And our great head of HUD, who's with us today, Ben Carson's going to say a few words in a moment. The Department of Education will not enforce standardized testing, which is another big deal, requirements for students in elementary through high school for the current school year. Not fair to do that. So we are waiving that. I would imagine it's probably the first time ever that's been waived, but I think it's only fair to the students and to the parents of the students. It is also waiving interest and other things that we're discussing right now on federally held student loans, and directed that borrowers be allowed to suspend their student loan payments without penalty for at least 60 days. And we'll be talking about student loans, going to help the students. They're under a great burden right now, so we will be talking about that further. But we're waiving during this 60-day period various elements and very important elements on student loans, big subject. I signed an executive order invoking the Defense Production Act, as you all know, giving us powerful new authorities to help states, cities, and hospitals procure needed supplies. There's been a clear call to action to the private sector, and the call is made right here. It's been really pretty amazing what's happened with the private sector. They are really in sixth gear, I think, which has responded in full force, helping to produce and supply much-needed masks, swabs, sanitizers, ventilators, and everything else. There's a move on that's incredible right now. And by way of example, Hanes, everybody knows Hanes, great company, great consumer cotton products company, is retrofitting its manufacturing capabilities in large sections of their plants to produce masks. And they're in that process right now. And in my direction, the FDA has taken rapid steps to make these items available for medical use right now. I mean, most excitingly to me is what the FDA has done in order to get possibly a very successful number. It's not just one or two, number of therapeutics, medicines that can help people that are already sick, help people not get sick, And obviously, you know about the vaccine, and Tony will discuss that a little bit later, but the vaccine is moving along. But this is something that right now, for right now, this is what we really, it's incredible. And what the FDA has done, and Dr. Stephen Hahn, who's highly respected, came as a highly respected man. He's been fantastic. He's only been here for a couple of months, and he's gotten thrown into the swim of it, and he's really standing up. But the FDA has really moved mountains. I said it this morning. They moved mountains to get approvals on things that that maybe work. We'll find out very soon. It won't take long. An example of the Pernod Ricard, which is this is really an example where we're repurposing alcohol. They went out and repurposed their alcohol production capabilities in Arkansas, Kentucky, Texas, and West Virginia to make hand sanitizer. That's a big difference. And they've been unbelievable. They really have. Pernod Ricard. Their first delivery will be on Tuesday. It's going to go to various states. They're going to start, I think, in New York, and they're going to work their way around. They're making a tremendous amount of hand sanitizer at a very high level, too, by the way. We've activated the National Response Coordination Center to level one. That's your highest level. This is the nerve center of all of our government response to crisis, and it's coordinating very closely with our nation's governors. Our nation's governors, many of you were at the call yesterday with the governors, and I think you can see the relationship, and we've had numerous calls with governors, by the way, but the relationships are pretty amazing. They're loving what we're doing, and the coordination between the federal government and the governors, states, and even local has been pretty incredible. FEMA Administrator Pete Gaynor, who is with us, will soon be providing you with an update on the center's operations. And FEMA's been incredible. We got them involved last week, very much involved, and now they're involved nationwide. We've dramatically expanded telehealth so Americans can see a doctor without leaving home, something which more and more people are using, and now they're really using it. And now the ones that are using it are loving it. And I think we're going to change the way our country functions medically and probably in other ways because of what's going on right now. This will reduce the chance of infection and preserve hospital capacity, so it solves a lot of problems. Every American has a role to play in defending our nation from this invisible, horrible enemy. It really is. It's an invisible enemy. And we will be successful, hopefully very much sooner than people would even think. So we say stay at home and save lives. This is a time of shared national sacrifice, but it's also a time to treasure our loved ones and to take stock of what is most important, our faith, our families, our neighbors, and our great country. And I want to thank all of the incredible people of our country, the citizens of our country, that what you've done and the way you're responding has just been very special. Something that we will never forget, that the history books will never forget. And we're going to have a great victory. We're going to be celebrating a great victory in the not-too-distant future. And I just want to thank everybody.
And there's more good news. According to an article on Yahoo Style, March 20, recent research suggests that the coronavirus death rate is lower than earlier WHO estimates. With the virus virtually unheard of at the start of the year, the article states, experts have been racing to uncover how dangerous it really is and the patients most likely to succumb to complications. At the beginning of March, the WHO announced the virus had killed 3.4% of patients worldwide, which other experts called a likely overestimate. To learn more, scientists from the University of Hong Kong looked at 48,557 confirmed cases that had arisen as of 29 February in the Chinese city of Wuhan, where the outbreak emerged. The article continues, they found the average death rate among patients under 30 was 0.3%, rising to 0.5% for those between 30 and 59, and 2.6% for people aged 60 or above. overall, they calculated the fatality rate to be about 1.4%. Although promising, the article cautions, experts have stressed estimating death rates in the midst of an outbreak is fraught with difficulties. So, yes, there's a lot going on, but this is at least something positive to consider. Still, this also shows that there is a lot we don't yet know about this disease, but it may not be the absolute killer many believe. An article March 20 in the Washington Examiner further emphasized this point. Titled Four Reasons for Hope in the Fight Against the Coronavirus, the article laid out these reasons. It begins, as the coronavirus has ripped through the planet and ground the global economy to a halt within a matter of weeks, there hasn't been much reason for optimism. While much of the news these days is discouraging, there are several reasons for hope. One, summer is coming. From the get-go, there had been informed speculation that the coronavirus would weaken in warmer weather based on our experience with the flu, but there was not much actual evidence to support it. We now have at least some research supporting it. One study out of China looked at data from different cities controlling for population density and found that, quote, high temperature and high humidity reduce the transmission of COVID-19, unquote. Another thing is spread is leveling off in other countries. The article continues, even if we discount the evidence from the Chinese government suggesting that there have been barely any new cases there for weeks, other countries, including Japan and South Korea, have seen their curves flatten. Now, it's true that those countries were much more aggressive early. South Korea has been a model to the world when it comes to widespread testing. The United States acted late, and our early efforts at testing have been hampered. So far, we're left hoping that draconian social distancing will be able to avoid a total breakdown of the medical system. That said, the article continues, the experiences of other countries show that it is possible to control the outbreak. And if it's too late to avoid significant damage this spring, those lessons will serve us well down the road as we brace for a possible fall resurgence. A third thing the article mentions is that there may be a drug that can help. Drugs that were first discovered in 1934 to fight malaria have shown some promise in fighting COVID-19. While the research that exists is limited and would need to be scaled up tremendously for us to have confidence it can work, the drugs, chloroquine and hydroxychloroquine, are already approved by the FDA from a safety perspective. Even though the agency can't yet vouch for its efficacy in treating the coronavirus, it means that doctors in the U.S. are free to try out the drugs on COVID-19 patients, and some are. Israeli generic drug maker Teva has announced that it would send U.S. hospitals 10 million doses of hydroxychloroquine, free of charge over the next month. The fourth reason, the article – I'm sorry. I don't think I have coronavirus, but I tend to cough more when I get dust in my lungs and pollen this time of year. Anyway. Going forward, the fourth reason the Washington Examiner noted was that private businesses are kicking into action. When the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention's coronavirus testing failed, the U.S. turned to private companies and labs to step in. And while testing is still nowhere near where it should be, the capacity has ramped up considerably in the past week. One reason why we're seeing a huge spike in reported cases. There's news that Ford, General Motors Company, and Tesla might start making ventilators, which are crucial to keeping those with severe cases of the disease breathing. On a smaller scale, we're seeing stories of adaptation and entrepreneurship. Some grocery stores are starting to offer special shopping hours for older and more vulnerable patients. A small Maryland distillery has shifted to making hand sanitizer. As noted above, it may be too late to avoid a strain on the medical system in the coming weeks. However, if we think of the fight against the coronavirus as a multi-wave fight between now and the time there is a vaccine, then these developments are encouraging. And I would add that there is reason to be encouraged by all this. While a coronavirus vaccine may be 18 months or more away, although I think they're trying to do everything they can to break that sooner. And the virus could have serious side effects, as have other vaccines. I mean, sorry, the vaccine could have serious side effects, as have other vaccines. There is much we can do now individually to help stay healthy and boost our immune systems, which is among the best things we can do to help us cope with this threat in the short term. Toward that end, let's listen to the New American Magazine's Christian Gomez interview MIT PhD scientist and candidate for U.S. Senate in Massachusetts, Dr. V. A. Shiva Ayaduri, about COVID-19. Dr. Ayaduri explains the nature of COVID-19 virus and what we can do to protect ourselves by boosting our immune systems. Play soundbite 2, please.
This is Christian Gomez with the New American Magazine, and on the show with us today is Dr. Shiva Ayaduri, PhD from MIT in biological engineering. Dr. Shiva, we're glad to have you on the show today.
Great to be here, Christian. Thanks for having me.
So, Dr. Shiva, can you tell us a little bit about yourself and your degree for those watching here on the show?
Yeah, I mean, my entire life has really been dedicated to health, but more particularly, what I call a systems approach to health. You know, I grew up in India as a kid, but also grew up in two worlds in India, in the city of Bombay, but also in a deep village in South India where my grandmother practiced traditional systems of Indian medicine. So I was very intrigued by medicine, and I came to the United States as a seven-year-old kid, grew up in New Jersey, and by the time I was 14, I was actually doing medical research as a full-time research fellow at what is now known as Rutgers Medical School, really applying computers, this is in 78, Christian, to understand diseases like when babies were dying in their sleep called SIDS. And that journey led me to actually create the first email system there in that university, which is a whole nother thing we can talk about at some point. But it led me to MIT. And, you know, I was a little bit disappointed because medicine actually, what I found out was particularly the conventional medicine looks at the body as parts, but it doesn't look at it as a system. So I went in and out of MIT, did 4 degrees in fields of electrical engineering, mechanical engineering, design. But in 2003, something fascinating happened, Christian. The world of biology was undergoing a revolution because we found out that we have the same number of genes as a worm. We have about 20,000 genes. The biologists had a mistaken notion that what makes human beings different than a worm was a number of genes. And it turns out it's not the number of genes. Complexity of systems is far more related to the interconnections of things. So that led to this field called systems biology. And in 2003, I came back to MIT and I did my PhD in a field called systems biology. And I created a new technology called Cytosolve, which allows the use of the computer to model molecular reactions, diseases on the computer. And so that's my background. In addition to the academic work, I've started 7 different companies. And the latest company I run is called Cytosolve, where we help major nutritional companies, even pharma companies, really use the computer and this approach to find new medicines faster, cheaper, and safer.
Okay, well, what's on everyone's mind, of course, right now is the COVID-19 coronavirus. So how is this virus different from other viruses or pandemics that have been plagued us for the last 100 years?
Well, I think, look, everything needs to be put into perspective here. First of all, China's starting to come back to work. I don't know if you know that, right? About 2,000 people roughly died there. It's not everyone in China died. The interesting thing with this virus, it is related to the SARS family of viruses. For example, SARS, which came out, had a low infectivity rate, but almost a 15% fatality rate. MERS, M-E-R-S, had a low infectivity rate, but nearly a 30% fatality rate. And when I talk about these viruses, they're known to be a class of viruses called zoonotic viruses, which means they start, both of the SARS and the MERS started with a bat. They went to an intermediary. In the case of SARS, it was the dog, raccoon. In the case of MERS, camel. And then they came to a human. What's interesting about this virus is they haven't been able to trace patient zero, okay? The original thought was it occurred in the Wuhan market, but they haven't been able to trace patient zero. But what we do know, what's emerging, is that this virus has a higher infectivity rate, And to put it in simple words, if you think about a cell as a big ball and a virus as a small ball, which is trying to penetrate that cell, your cell, and take over its cellular machinery to replicate itself, this virus appears to have a bigger stickiness to your cell wall. So that's called a higher infectivity rate. But relative MERS and SARS are much lower, you know, a much lower fatality rate. But I think one of the things that I want to share with people is that MDs and pediatricians, most of them are really not trained to understand the complexity of the immune system. For that matter, even most biologists out there, the immune system is a very complex system. And what emerges out of that understanding is if you really look at it, it's not the virus that harms and kills people. This may be counterintuitive because of so much of the news media scaring people. What actually harms people is an overactive immune system. The majority of people, if you notice, are not dying like flies. The people who are dying, for example, in the United States, I think pretty much the overwhelming number of the people, about 100, 200 people have died, are over the age of 80. So it's a weakened and compromised immune system, what we call the immunosuppressed, that are being affected, because what happens in a compromised immune system is your own body's cytokines or molecules start attacking parts of your body. In the normal case, people have a normal immune system. You get a virus, the innate immune system turns on, the interferon, your microbiome, etc., and your body sort of, you get a mild reaction, you go on. But broadly, whether it's corona or not, it's the immunocompromised who have a reaction and starts attacking parts of your body. You know, 22,000 people have died, for example, of the flu. So we need to understand that the policies that need to come out cannot be sort of this one-size-fit-all policy, which is taking place right now, and it can have devastating effects on economic policy. The real issue is in the modern world, we need to understand 4 billion people travel, 4 times more than SARS, and we need to have a much more prudent way of doing this. And my view is that you look at the immunocompromised, the seniors, the people who are perhaps really overweight or diabetes, and we protect them, but it doesn't mean you shut down the entire economy. These could have massive ramifications for a country like the United States.
So in the city of Wuhan, where this whole infection of the virus started, they've had over 48,557 cases, but only 2,169 of those cases resulted in deaths. So there's reports coming out this morning on NBC News and elsewhere that the infected mortality, I guess that the 1.4% of those who have been infected have died, at least in Wuhan. So is that a staggering number compared to other viruses?
So that's the 58,000 we know who were infected, right? There could be a substantially 10 times more people infected who are asymptomatic. You follow? They don't have enough tests to pass out to all those people. I hope I'm being clear on that.
So the numbers could be much more diluted then.
What I'm saying is we don't know what the denominator is, okay? And what I find fascinating about this, when I look at it, you know, I'm also a student who looks at politics, right? And medicine, because of my background, you know, I grew up in India, which had a caste system. As a kid, I saw the injustices of that. I also was interested in medicine. So I've also studied political systems. And what you see is, let's just sort of turn back the clock back to whatever, 3 months ago. Hong Kong was blowing up. Do you remember that? Massive protests in Hong Kong. In Wuhan itself, 6 months before this, there were massive protests in Wuhan itself. 10,000 people were taking to the streets because China has a huge problem in pollution, garbage, and they are starting to build huge incinerator plants. And the people in Wuhan had enough of this. And you know, in China, it's not like if you protest, you get treated fine, right? You take yourself at risk. And there were massive pollution protests, anti-pollution protests, I'm sorry, in Wuhan itself. Everyone talks about Hong Kong. And my view is this is fascinating because we don't hear anything about Hong Kong anymore. We don't hear anything about Wuhan. And we also have to understand in the United States, there was a growing movement to not essentially vaccinate everyone, right? The freedom, what's called medical freedom. And what I see happening here, the fear mongering that has taken place can have devastating effects to the U.S. economy. And next year, what's going to happen? We're going to all be mandated vaccines. You follow what I'm saying? It's a very interesting situation that we're heading into, saying as though, look, I'm not saying we should not wash hands, not do those kinds of things, but you should do this in any kind of infectious disease situation. But does that mean that the only solution is to medical interventions like drugs and vaccines? The opportunity for us is really to talk about immune health. And that discussion, Christian, is not occurring. We're not talking about how we really talk about immune health. If you look at the history of this country, in the 1900s, 14 out of 100,000 people were dying of infectious diseases. By 1950 or so, before even the polio vaccine, 98% of infectious diseases had disappeared. Not because of medical interventions or vaccines, sanitation, vitamin A, nutrition, elimination of child labor, refrigeration. All of those things drastically brought it down. The plumber and the sanitation worker did more for infectious diseases than the doctor or the pharmacist. We need to keep this in perspective. Today in the United States, we have dirty air, dirty water, dirty food. In a place like we have crumbling infrastructure, the United States got a D plus in infrastructure. Massachusetts, which hosts MIT, okay, got a F minus minus in infrastructure. And infrastructure is how we really protect our health. And so what I find fascinating is when Massachusetts got an F minus minus in infrastructure, when we have 30% people being obese, I don't see a state of emergency being called. So, you know, I study the immune system. And what I can tell you is if we want to talk about public health, we need to have a broader discussion of how do we beef up people's immune health. And that discussion is not occurring. And so that tells me there's a hypocrisy here that's taking place.
So what are some common sense measures that those watching could take to boost up their immune health right now that are watching?
Well, first of all, you know, food is medicine, right? This goes back thousands of years, right? Real doctors really understand this. Real healers understand this. So first of all, let's take what happens when you age. Well, two things happen. Your thyroid actually goes down in function. And why is that of concern? Because when your thyroid goes down in function, your body stops producing enough vitamin A because your thyroid takes carotenoids, you know, from fruits and vegetables, and it converts into vitamin A. Why is vitamin A important? Well, vitamin A, it creates cytokeratins to protect your cells from impingement of other pathogens. So if you have low vitamin A, by the way, vitamin A is not a vitamin, it's a hormone. It modulates all sorts of immune functions. So one is people should have their vitamin A levels tested. First step. The second thing is vitamin D. Well, vitamin D, that's why when people say when the sun comes out, a lot of this stuff may go away, because vitamin D we get from the sun, and vitamin D also modulates many other immune processes, and vitamin C. The other thing that happens as you age, for example, aging population, your HCL levels drop in your gut. When HCL's levels drop, which is hydrochloric acid, you perturb your gut microbiome, you know, all those good bacteria in your gut. So simply put, you know, for aging people, they should look at their hydrochloric levels in their gut and vitamin A in their body, and look at vitamin D and C because these support your immune system. The second thing is if you look at a diet that's composed of sugars, sugar creates candida. Candida creates the gliotoxins, and those toxins suppress two important things, your macrophages in your innate system and your T cells. So you actually suppress that. And when you suppress those natural things which modulate your immune system, other things like cytokines come. So what I'm trying to say is let's go back to eating right, you know? Whole foods, organic foods, not pesticide-ridden foods. It starts with foods. That's where this really comes from.
Okay, Dr. Shiva, thank you for joining us on the show. And for those watching, how could they learn more about you? Any web pages you have to offer?
Sure. I mean, there's people should know that I'm running for United States Senate. In addition to being a scientist and an inventor and entrepreneur, I want to bring my skills to support this country. So if people want to learn more about the Senate campaign, they can go to Shiva4Senate.com. Or if they want to know what I do for a living, they can go to V as in Victor, A, Shiva, Shiva.com.
Okay. Thank you so much for joining us on the show. Take care and God bless, Dr. Shiva.
Thank you. God bless you too.
Also, besides eating better quality food and avoiding junk foods, consider nutritional supplements as a means of improving your health and preventing diseases like COVID-19. As with anything you take internally, you need to be careful and, if possible, consult with a healthcare professional about taking supplements. If your healthcare professional you're dealing with knows anything about this. But there is a world of wonderful substances besides things like vitamin A and D that you could consider, which might help you improve your overall health and your immune system with it. For example, after being very ill for weeks last year with a severe case of the flu and its after effects that numerous other people in a large office I work in came down with, I came across an interesting article in the official magazine of a high-end nutritional supplement company called Life Extension. You can find them on the internet at LifeExtension, that's with two E's, .com, LifeExtension.com. And this article had some very interesting information about what you can do to help avoid and lessen the severity of the flu and other viruses. At that time, there's no mention of COVID-19. Of course, it wasn't known to have existed, but I'm thinking some of this stuff might also help, although this is generalities. I'm not a doctor. But it was interesting that they mentioned some substances like elderberry and French oakwood extract. WebMD, which is the medical establishment, does look at some of these supplements and nutritional substances, and they mentioned that elderberry has the same effect as Tamiflu in helping to prevent the replication of the flu virus. Well, there's a wide assortment of elderberry supplements, extracts, capsules. You can get elderberry juice. You can get elderberry syrup. Again, avoiding sugar is probably a good idea, but in taking these things, among other substances I also take nutritionally, as preventive, this year for the first time – that was last year when I got sick. This year for the first time this season, late last year, early this year, I have not so far come down with the flu or even a cold. I can't say for certain that it was because of these things, but I believe they definitely helped me. So if you're interested, you can go out and do research and consult with a medical professional if at all possible. You can also find some of these people on the internet, and there's a lot of good solid research behind this stuff. What I'm trying to say here is there's a lot of things you can do to help yourself, which might be much better in the short run than relying on the medical establishment to bring you through this. Anyway, some food for thought. If you're interested, there's lots of great information about supplements on the internet, so get out there and do some research. That's it for another show. Hope you found what we presented of value. Look for us 2 weeks from today in this same time slot, and stay well.